Waking up in the early hours of the morning, you find yourself drawn once more to the mighty stump which lay in the center of your village. Only 5 years before, it had been a giant oak, towering into the sky, shading almost the entirety of the hilltop. You remember your parents telling stories of the Tree of Life, and how this tree carried with it the power of the divine, connecting the gods to the men on Earth. It had been the center around which your village had organized, legitimizing its many councils, which had become increasingly frantic with the news of the invading Franks. The Franks, seemingly, had marked your village as one of importance, an administrative center, and marched towards it, scattering any forces organized against them. You have a memory of the first men to reach your village, horsemen, lightly armored, carrying shield and spear. The men in the village would continue to resist, attacking from the dense forest surrounding, but they were soon defeated. As the mass of men in iron marched behind, they would begin to raise the land around you, putting to the sword many of the families you knew best. In desperation, you had ran into the woods, where you would see the flitter of Frankish banners ride to and fro across your village, emptying it of life. Not long after, that mighty tree, the immortal connection to the divine, would be almost effortlessly chopped to the ground by a man dressed in robes. The pain of this sight was what made you attempt to run further away. This did not work, and soon you found yourself before the man holding the axe, the one in the robes who had slain the great tree. Although you feared the worst, what felt like so long ago, instead of the axe's sharp blade, what you felt instead were the soft words of this conqueror. "Stand, boy. Do you see what has happened? You have been fooled into believing this tree would be your savior." He brought you over to the fresh stump as the men in iron dispersed. "Though you and I are as weak as this tree, and cruelty has settled into the world around us, the Lord saw fit to save you, and it is in him that you will find strength mightier than the forest itself." Over the next years, the man would take you under his wing, recruiting you to assist in the construction of a new abbey nearby. Around you, new men had moved in from the south. Franks, like the men who had destroyed your village only months prior. Among them are soldiers, called to man the small hill fort which had once housed the local Saxons. This had, over the course of time, been significantly expanded, not only repairing the fortifications, but adding palisades as well. You hear from these men that your Saxon leaders had fled north, into the land of the pagan Danes. Though these were once your countrymen, news of them now inspires fear, as their ferocity is known. Anyone who was seen as having been drawn into these new ways was liable to be slain along with the Franks who now inhabited the village. As for you, the priests had received over the last years several scripts from the city of Aachen, not too many days away. Over time, he had encouraged you into the church, teaching you how to read this strange-looking script of a language he called Latin. Though you had learned much, you still simmered with resentment at what the Franks had done to your village and family. It was only now, staring down once more at this stump, that you muster up the courage to ask the priest why those men had destroyed your village, and why he decided to save you. The man with the axe pondered for a while, before responding, "As my mentor Alcuin says, one must accept Christ through their own free will, not the will of their enemy's spear. Though our realm may reach for the spear to strengthen itself, it is up only to us to strengthen the men around us. So while it may be best to accept your fallen situation, you must also reject the sins it will ask of you." To you, this made for a very quick connection. Embrace the new identity of your humble home, reject the mighty Carolingian Empire. To Between the Seas. Today, we'll take a look at what happened to Charlemagne's empire after his death in 814. The Carolingians, though boosted by the overwhelming legitimacy of Charlemagne, would face increasingly insurmountable obstacles to a new universal empire, from foreign invasion to internal fragmentation and separatism. All of this will lead to the empire's decline as the institution it was imagined to be initially. However, its decline will bring about the feudal, church, and town structures of the future concrete institution of the Holy Roman Empire, and influence all of inner Europe in the process. So, we resume our story in the year 814 itself, with the death of Charlemagne. It's unclear if Charlemagne had planned much further than the solidification of his own personal glory. The imperial title granted to him by the Pope was regarded as a statement of personal prestige, solidifying his influence over the magnates of Europe. While his multiple sons were alive, he had planned to once more divide the lands between them, leaving the emperor title to presumably be claimed once more by the most able. However, fate would intervene to leave only one son of Charlemagne alive by his final years, that being Louis I, who had been serving under his father as the King of Aquitaine. Charlemagne would raise Louis to be the co-emperor prior to his death, a common Byzantine practice to designate heirs despite the lack of an established succession system. Giving this title was likely necessary in order for Louis to gain control over all of Charlemagne's gains, as without a local Carolingian lord, the nobles may have been just as likely to acclaim one of their own. Louis I would take no chances upon his father's death, rushing to Aachen from Aquitaine to take on imperial responsibilities. He would quickly petition the Pope for an imperial coronation, a request the Pope would grant in 816. Louis would very quickly face a problem with his vast inheritance. By all accounts, he was not the imposing warrior king figure of his father. Charlemagne had held together his web of military elites through both his force of personality and his generous land grants to key military allies following the conquest of a region. Louis would have neither of these advantages. He was a smaller and less charismatic figure, and though an able, experienced administrator, he lacked the gravitas and respectability of his father. He would also be unable to appease his elites with land grants due to the already massive nature of his empire. Further expansion would have been too costly and destabilizing, as his realm was now surrounded by the powerful Muslims to the south, and a dense web of pagan tribes to his north and east. Major expansion in any of these directions would have been akin to a rerun of Charlemagne's Saxon Wars, which despite all of his advantages, had taken a full 30 years to complete. So, deprived of this same key to success, he would utilize a different strategy, one perhaps closer to the Romans of old, creating widely recognized institutions. The first order of business would be depersonalizing the organs of state. Force of personality would now be insufficient to rely on, being replaced with legally binding imperial decrees. Louis would make liberal use of his power to send these written decrees within his first few years, far outpacing the decrees of his father. These decrees would naturally channel the legitimacy of their demands to the position of emperor itself, rather than to Louis the person. The primary document of these institutionalizing decrees would be the Ordinato Imperii, or the Imperial Ordinance of 817. In this document, Louis would outline his succession plans, despite being only 3 years into his reign, which was a far cry from previous Frankish rulers. In it, he established his oldest son as the inheritor of the empire, along with the wealthiest lands in the middle, comprising a large part of former Austrasia and Neustria, along with the entirety of Burgundy and Italy. His younger two sons would be placed on either periphery, tasked with protecting the empire's borders. The oldest son would be given sole power over his brothers, including the ability to sanction them should they prove to be repeatedly sacrilegious or disobedient to their duties. He would also outline laws for premature deaths of any of his sons, with the result always being the strengthening of the imperial power. The empire in this document was recognized as a real entity outside of the ruler, rather than the personal title of prestige it had been only a few years prior. Louis would also formalize the power of the emperors in relation to the papacy. Whereas Charlemagne and the Pope had been in alliance before, the relationship had not been formalized for the long term, rather left to an understanding. Louis would act to formalize the role of emperor as the protector of the church, assigning the popes the role of helper, who would provide the emperor with the necessary justifications, doctrine, and infrastructure for him to maintain uniformity of doctrine and protection of the church. The emperor, as the superior partner, had the power to select bishops, to pursue wars of church expansion or defense, and to make necessary subdivisions in order to better enforce the church's will. Importantly, the emperor's selection for heirs would be deemed as enough to obligate the pope to coronate them as emperor. Louis would also lean in outwardly to his role as protector of the church, and build the image of a man serving in the image of God, for the common will of Christendom, rather than for himself or his family. He would start early by attempting to purify the capital, removing prostitutes and sending his more promiscuous family members into nunneries. He would also regularly pursue acts of voluntary penance for his sins, appealing to the church to forgive him for his inadequacies, and performing works to support them. All of these acts would earn him the epithet of the Pious, thus immortalizing him as Louis the Pious. As a side note, these epithets will become increasingly common for the next centuries, and first came into common usage during this period of the early Middle Ages. I found them to be extremely helpful for memory of the named characters, and also quite funny as a blunt and honest one-word introduction. His most famous act of penance would come in an episode with his sons, which will begin a saga of severe consequence for the fate of Europe. In the 820s, Louis would marry an influential woman named Judith, who had earned a reputation for wickedness among many influential magnates of Europe. Soon, the pair would have a child, and this child would be railroaded into power as the heir of Aquitaine. The problem came with the fact that Louis already had three sons, all to the same mother, who this half-brother would now be interfering with by derailing their outlined succession plans. So, the original three sons would go into revolt in 830 against their father, gaining the support of several who distrusted Judith and believed the emperor needed guidance away from her. Surprisingly, Louis would submit to his sons, starting his act of penance. He would announce abdication from the throne, renouncing his responsibilities and asking forgiveness for his many faults in ruling. He would admit to a laundry list of failed obligations and sins against the church, retiring in shame. This act of humility and penance would help to earn him respect back from his rebellious aristocracy, and would soon accept his return in 834. Succession would be the true test of Louis's reforms. The original draft had been drawn up in 817, outlining a rational, if perhaps idealistic, granting of land to one main heir for power. Notably, this plan assigned the lands of Italy to his son, despite Italy already being under Louis as a separate kingdom led by his nephew. Perhaps blindsided by this, his nephew would revolt against Louis, but be crushed and blinded in Byzantine fashion. Similarly to this empire's imitations of Byzantine traditions, however, the blinding would be botched, and Louis's nephew would die instead. Following this inspired but ungraceful start to succession plans, Louis would add another son to the mix, leading to the aforementioned revolt of the brothers. After the reinstatement, succession would be open until 840, when formal plans were called back to the drawing board. This time, lands of inheritance were left to the three remaining sons themselves to draw up and then select. The general theme of the Ordinance of 817 remained, with a primary kingdom occupying both Italy and the traditional Frankish heartlands, being taken by the oldest son Lothar, while the half-brother Charles the Bald took West Francia, encompassing parts of Neustria and all of Aquitaine, while Lothar's brother Louis II took East Francia, lands corresponding to lands on the plateau outside of the Austrasian heartlands. Louis the Pious would die soon after, and we will now shift protagonist to his son Louis II, who tellingly will come to be known as Louis the German. The three brothers would come to blows instantly after their father's death over the issue of imperial sovereignty. According to the original plan, Lothar was to have legal dominion over the other two, encouraging cooperation and assistance to Lothar as the oldest. This arrangement had lessened somewhat by 840, with large autonomy acknowledged for the other two, but still remained as an ambiguous loose end. Lothar would claim this privilege, leading Charles the Bald and Louis the German to team up against their older brother. Largely due to the indefensible setup of Lothar's kingdom in relation to the other two, Charles and Louis would win, with all three coming to an agreement in 843, known as the Treaty of Verdun. Here, Louis II would successfully claim East Francia, as extending all the way to the Rhine in several areas, including many of the old Austrasian heartlands. Lothar's Middle Kingdom would still exist, though in diminished shape and with no real power over the other two. Louis the German had clearly come out on top from all of these negotiations, revolts, and open conflicts. He had successfully improved himself from a starting point of only Bavaria to now include the cores of all the leading Germanic tribes, those being Saxony, Franconia, Swabia, and Bavaria. He had essentially created a coherent kingdom out of a union of these tribes, which shared a German aristocracy and increasingly spoke dialects of Old German. The four major tribes of Germany will be known as Stem Duchies, and will be much larger and more powerful than most duchies found in other parts of Europe. We will talk about each of them in turn later in the episode, but for now, let's complete Louis II's story with a pivot to the fate of Lotharingia, or the Middle Kingdom. After his defeat, Lothar would maintain Lotharingia as a separate state until his death in 855. He would partition his vast realm into three chunks for each of his sons with the Treaty of Prun. Through this agreement, northern Italy was split from the lands between East and West Francia. Out of what was left, a Burgundian or provincial realm would emerge in the south, while Lotharingia, better known as Lorraine, would emerge in the north. These lands proved to be coherent realms, whose identities would be fought for long into the future. Lorraine, in particular, would emerge as the main battleground between East and West Francia, and will be the subject of the remaining Frankish conflicts in the 9th century. The son of Lothar, who ruled Lorraine, would die in 869, and the half-brothers of Charles the Bald and Louis the German would seize the lands for West and East Francia, respectively. The specific partition would come with much tension, being formally settled by the Treaty of Meersen in 870. As part of this division, Louis would expand across the Rhine to claim the vast majority of former Austrasia, further solidifying his dominant position. The conclusion to this struggle over Lorraine would come with the death of Louis the German, which ignited another war for the territory. Louis III, Louis II's son, who had been granted lands in the east and who had assumed succession of East Francia, would rebuff his uncle Charles the Bold, and instead counterattack. This attack would be enhanced due to the death of Charles shortly after, and the chaotic succession of two sons which followed. Louis would stop his counter-invasion after securing the entirety of Lorraine for East Francia, which was confirmed in 880 at the Treaty of Ribemont. Unlike the other treaties, this one would largely last as an acceptable division of influence. Lorraine would indeed find itself paired with the lands of East Francia centuries into the future, and last further chaotic partitions with this union still intact. With that, Louis III would now be in a similarly dominant position as his father had been. And with such a similar name, too, he would very aptly be known simply as Louis the Younger. Further Frankish succession shenanigans would follow, before soon enough the entire realm, all five lands created by the Treaty of Prüm, would be united under Louis the Younger's brother Charles. Charles, however, would be known as a weak and ineffective ruler, and gained significant flak from paying off Viking invaders to the north. He was also known as being a ruler who simply inherited all of his gains, with every realm simply falling into his lap. As a result, he will become endearingly known as Charles the Fat. So after all that, it seems like we reached a very similar point, where the Frankish realms were briefly united again. As we've seen since the 500s, this wasn't necessarily groundbreaking. Most likely, it would just be divided among Charles's sons upon his death, starting the whole round over again. Or so you would think. Things will, actually, really be different this time, and its cause lay in that force that we have been gradually following over the last several episodes, the aristocracy. So, before we get into the real fall of the Carolingians, let's open up the hood once more to look at how and why the aristocracy developed the way it did on the plateau, and what its influence actually looks like at this point. When we last left off with the story of the aristocracy, it had been developed into strong regional forces comprising several powerful families, who had been able to build local power bases throughout the conflicts of the Frankish kingdoms. Under Charlemagne, the power bases had remained informal, just enough to maintain them as a strong force necessary for running the state, but without permanent legal influence for the family in most cases. Administration of these local populations was a privilege granted to those close to the Frankish central government. And with these entrenched power bases, local families were often able to incorporate themselves into administration through these grants. Over time, these grants, to utilize lands and taxes worked by a population, would become known as fiefs, and would be recognized as a formal reward for loyal service. As we will recall, these influential local forces had been relied upon along with the church for local administration, and, most importantly, for local mobilization. During Charlemagne's time, they would possess their own scaras, or retinues of professional horsemen, and could augment these forces with local levies by executing a mobilization order from the emperor. Due to reliance on these forces as the bureaucracy themselves, execution of these mobilizations was subject to a lot of control from the dukes or counts temporarily granted the fief, and these forces were liable to be more loyal to them than to the emperor themselves. Keeping these local military executors in mind was of top importance, and could be done through the practice of gift-giving and bestowing honors, which was a very important ritual among the Germanic elites. Allowing influential families within Charlemagne's military hierarchy to take fiefs from newly conquered lands was the primary way he and his predecessors had maintained dominant influence over all of these local interests. Herein, though, we find the problem. The importance of gift-giving to the Germanic political formula encourages an offensive state, as claiming new lands then allows you to easily grant these lands to please key supporters. Under Charlemagne, this state was geared entirely towards the offensive, something it succeeded extraordinarily in. However, Charlemagne would expand to the point that going on the offensive on any of its remaining borders would have been extremely difficult. As mentioned before, in Spain there were the Muslims, organized as a Mediterranean state and at the height of their power. Any war against them would have been costly and not guaranteed of success. The same pattern was true in southern Italy and Sicily, which the Muslims would invade around this time. To the north and east, meanwhile, were a series of shattered pagan tribes inhabiting sparsely developed land. Invading these lands would have required an investment similar to the Saxon Wars, which, as we mentioned before, were difficult even for Charlemagne, and ended only with the removal of a large amount of the population. The church administration was really needed to facilitate expansion of the empire or Christendom, and the church needed some time to catch up with the empire's recent expansion. To add on to this, the empire was now greatly overextended, and faced consistent raiding by each of these outside factions, along with insurmountable internal forces looking for their own paths. With the death of Charlemagne, the central administration would lose the extremely strong legitimacy gained by so much conquest, and be forced to contract, being put firmly on the defensive. The Frankish Empire was never meant to have a defensive posture. Without new lands, rulers would be forced to placate key allies and reward loyal service out of their own resources, using their own wealth and influence. This process was not sustainable for such a large and diverse empire, and would serve to erode the social position of the ruler, as well as exhaust their monetary resources. Several other factors would also combine to both accelerate this process and increase the social positions of the local families. First, the nature of preferred warfare would change in the 9th century with the introduction of the stirrup into the staras. This would combine with the innovations of Charlemagne's time, namely the greater focus on armor for horsemen and the power of offensive tactics, to greatly improve the effectiveness of cavalry. Many of these innovations came from the conquest of the Avars, and once incorporated, would spread through all levels of the military hierarchy. Carolingian successors would continue to focus on offensive tactics and warfare, despite the emperor's new position, and cavalry would be dominant to these ends. They could be used for scouting, harassing, raiding, laying ambushes, facilitating coordination, and pulling off complex maneuvers. Focusing on the cavalry also helped with power projection and visible prestige, which was still utilized by the Carolingian leaders. As a result of these innovations, cavalry adoption skyrocketed in the 9th century, with rulers focusing their diminished resources on these new offensive tactics to help them in their offensive wars of reunification against their brothers. The victory in these wars would come with specially placating their local interests to gain legitimacy, rather than distributing their lands to their followers. Thus, focusing on these wars would both expend their resources relative to the growing aristocracies, and also sacrifice their defensive capabilities, This, unfortunately for them, coincided with the rise in power of many of those forces along the northern and eastern borders of East Francia, namely the Scandinavian Vikings and the Slavs. Both groups would launch devastating raids into Carolingian lands, and due to the focused nature of Carolingian forces, local interests would be forced to provide for their own defense in most cases. This would lead to increased fortifications along the borderlands, and the rallying of localities behind their local elites for military support, rather than the Carolingian leadership. The plateau in northern Germany would be quite successful in fending off these attacks, largely due to the tribal unity of the Stem Duchies and the remaining prevalence among local forces of infantry. In contrast, when Imperial cavalry armies did meet with the Vikings, results were mixed, and so paying them off was preferred. This served not only to diminish central resources even more, but also to weaken trust among vassals. All of these factors served to overhaul the internal relationships of the Frankish realms, with rulers possessing increasingly less leverage and influence. Warring between local administrators within the same realm would become common during this time with the reduced oversight and fragmentation. And unlike the kings, local followers could be rewarded with formal land grants, solidifying support for the local aristocracies. By the late 9th century and early 10th century, the power differential had reached a point that rulers would need to pawn off their own authority to these aristocrats, resuming their gift-giving rituals in the form of granting privileges. Lifetime appointments, hereditary rule, and local autonomy were granted slowly over time since the initial strengthening of localities in the 600s, but it really accelerated during this time of Carolingian conflict. Through the process of a lifetime appointment here, hereditary rule there, and increasing precedence in permanent aristocratic houses, the nobility of the Middle Ages would be created. As land ownership is one of the most important factors for understanding a society, and the aristocracy will be the most important social group within inner Europe for the next 1,000 years, the process taking place during this time is one of the most critical developments of our story. I'll dedicate an episode later during the transition to the High Middle Ages on the development of the various medieval estates, including those parts of inner Europe outside of the plateau as well, so we can summarize the developments of these past episodes in one place. But for now, we know that a hereditary aristocracy has developed, and their houses will become important players in the inner European story. Besides the aristocracy, local interests would join the trend of becoming increasingly powerful during this time for other reasons as well. The improved Hilforths, often converted from the conquered tribes which constituted the German Stem Duchies, would serve to greatly enhance the identity of the locality and promote more autonomies for its population, as the central government forcing control over the land was now made significantly more difficult. The fortification of the countryside was reflected as an obstacle to central control through the actions of Charles the Bald in 864, where he attempted to ban Newcastle construction and ordered the destruction of those in the interior. His order was clearly not followed by the locals who had just fortified themselves against the threats he had failed to protect them from, showing their increased assertiveness and autonomy. Economically, localities were also enhancing their position. Trade routes, which had declined after the fall of Rome and the de-urbanization of the Dark Ages, had begun to return to inner Europe by the 9th century, including the all-important Amber Road. Slaves were a very common sight in markets across inner Europe, though materials of all kinds also increased among traders, including the trademark Carpathian raw goods of the hills, along with honey and furs from the forest. Slavic metalworking would also begin to emerge as its own art, increasing the value of trade across the whole region. To go along with this, the concept of the medieval fair would emerge, wherein a certain city would be designated by local notables or the ruling elite to to host a special market, during which mercantile and cultural forces from across the wider region would converge to exchange goods and ideas. These fairs would improve the relative wealth of localities which took part, as well as inspire productive development to supply the burgeoning trade routes. Coupling with these developments, local regions would begin to shine on their own and develop unique identities. The tools granted during the reforms of Charlemagne and Louis the Pious would filter down to the provinces through the church, and parishes would begin to branch out. Regional literature would be developed, while new hymns and poems would work to formalize local dialects. Church construction and Romanesque techniques would begin to show across the countryside, building new towns and villages. Local stones used in construction would give each settlement its own unique style, with each church embodying the creative spirit of the local population. The stem duchies of East Francia were based upon the tribal identities which existed prior, and served as great templates to differentiate cultures. Bavaria would lead the way in creating an identity as inheritors of the old Bavarian Confederation. Their lands would become quite locally centralized under their dukes, and they would also lead the way in asserting aristocratic and regional privileges for the nobility of East Francia. Saxony, developed around the recently conquered Saxon identity, would develop to be similarly centralized, uniting as a method to beat back the Slavs and Vikings on their borders. They would come to be more heavily fortified and boast significant infantry forces and prestige from winning defensive battles against heathens. The other two stem duchies, Franconia, developing from the old riparian Franks along the Rhine and Main rivers, and Suabia, developing from the Alemanni tribal identity on the southwest plateau, would develop to be even internally decentralized. They would develop rich cultures from the patchwork of aristocratic, church, and countryside interests across the land. Franconia could be considered the cultural heart at this time, while the Swabians would boast a strong monastic culture and uniquely powerful longbowmen. And with the increasingly powerful hereditary aristocracy and the increasingly assertive and wealthy localities, it's time to return to the historical narrative. Charles the Fat would lead a reunited Frankish Empire for only 2 years, before he would face a revolt led by the aristocracy. The local forces of East Francia would unite to elect Arnulf, Margrave of Carinthia, as their leader. In the face of the ire of the united aristocracy of East Francia, Charles would yield, allowing East Francia to go their own way under Arnulf in 887. Arnulf was a bastard of Carloman, son of Louis the German, which made him still technically a Carolingian. This was what gave him the legitimacy to be granted the kingship on the surface, though the reality of his power lay in the noble election itself. Power now had to be shared with this significant force, and any leader who truly wished to lead could only do so through consensus. Meanwhile, the other realms of the empire would be spurred on by this revolt to also elect their own kings, denying Arnulf from ruling them all. This showed the similar process of royal degradation in all of the realms, with those out west being even more affected by Viking raiding and collapse of central authority. East Francia would retain a sort of order with their stem duchies and protection from raiding, while Italy and West Francia would be fully dominated by local interests. Townships would rise in Italy, while a very decentralized version of feudalism would take place in France, as West Francia would be known after the Carolingians. As for Lorraine, Arnulf would move in quickly to secure what was agreed at the Treaty of Ribemont, unifying it again with East Francia. He would retain its autonomy by placing his own bastard on the throne, though under his rule. Lorraine would prove to be a more distant borderland of the plateau for much of its medieval history, the more fractured form of administration dominating when compared to East Francia. Arnulf would rule as a committed soldier king, being pulled into an Italian quagmire for the majority of his reign. This, as we will find, will become a very popular pastime for future German kings. Eventually, though, his health would decline, leaving him mostly incapable of his duties. With that, if the power of the aristocracy over the Carolingians hadn't been secured before, it surely was now, as they ruled in his stead. He would die in 899, with the nobles choosing to raise his 6-year-old son, Louis, as king. The toddler Louis, appropriately given the epithet Louis the Child, always on the mark with those names, would predictably be dominated by the aristocracy during his reign. However, all parties involved would soon be humbled by the arrival of a terrifying new threat, the Magyar. To many, this was hailed as the return of the Huns, and the Magyar would arrive on the plateau in force, regularly ravaging the lands of East Francia. In the Battle of Pressburg of 907, many leading members of the burgeoning aristocracy were slain, critically weakening control of the state. By 910, Louis the Child would be grown enough to lead his own army against them, though he would be defeated just as decisively at the Battle of Augsburg. Driven to the depths of despair, he would die just 1 year later, at the age of 18. With that, the nobles of East Francia would not choose to elect another Carolingian. The Frankish Empire continued to exist in name, though it was now a mockery of its former self in Italy, as local dukes strong-armed the Pope for the title. The Carolingians had truly fallen, and inner Europe would prepare for what came next. Thank you for listening to Between the Seas. This episode took us a little bit ahead of ourselves, so that we could see the full narrative of the fall of the Carolingians. There are several points I would like to return to before fully moving into the 10th century, as the 9th would prove to be immensely important for future development across the region, and will set up the many famous moments of the 10th. Next episode will start that, with a pivot away from the plateau. Look at the Rivelands and Carpathia in the early 9th century, a region dominated by new and foreign concepts, and the chaotic creation and dissolution of military frontiers known as marches. But, until then, this has been Jacob, and I hope you can find yourself an epithet worthy of your likeness.